Hello everyone, welcome to the Scientific Sense podcast, where we explore emerging ideas from science, policy, economics, and technology. My name is Gil Epen. We talk with world's leading academics and experts about their recent research or general areas of topical interest. Scientific Sense is an unstructured conversation with no agenda or preparation. We cover a wide variety of domains where new discoveries are made and new technologies are developed on a daily basis. We are most interested in how ideas affect society and help educate the world how to pursue a rewarding and enjoyable life rooted in science, logic, and information. We seek knowledge without boundaries and constraints and provide unedited content of conversations with researchers and leaders who love what they do. A companion blog to this podcast can be found at scientificsense.com. And this podcast is available on over a dozen platforms and directly at scientificsense.net. If you have suggestions for topics, guests, and other ideas, please send them to info@scientificsense.com. And I can be reached at gil@epen.info. My guest today is Professor Anthony Losaso, who's Professor of Economics at DePaul University in Chicago. His research spans several dimensions of health economics and health services research. Welcome, Tom.
Great to be here, Gil. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for doing this. I got a number of your papers, and I want to start with occupational licensing and healthcare labor market. It's really interesting. Mm-hmm. So you say here we examine the labor market impact of states easing occupational license requirements by expanding the scope of practice for nurse practitioners, allowing them to practice without physician oversight. Using data on job postings, you say we find that employers increase the demand for nurse practitioners when states expand their scope of practice. So we then show that scope of practice laws also increase nurse practitioner earnings and reallocate nurse practitioners across the healthcare sector, including increasing self-employment. So all of that is very intuitive from an economic perspective, but you also find some counterintuitive things here. So this data here is from Illinois, right? The 30% decrease.
So there was a couple papers I sent you. There's one recent paper that's in press right now with a journal is studying scope of practice laws as they relate to nurse practitioners. And so scope of practice, you know, this is one of these areas that it's kind of an old one in economics generally. It has to do with kind of licensing and certification of different types of, and healthcare, as you know, is one of those areas where virtually everybody needs some kind of license.
But it also defines,
so it allows generally states to define the so-called scope of practice, what the particular provider can do with the license. And so what's happened in a lot of states largely well-intentioned reasons, and those often have to do with improving access to primary care, where you're in a situation where, there might be a shortage of general practice, GPs, and primary care physicians. You know, not everybody with an upper respiratory infection or a child that has, an ear infection or something along those lines, it needs to see a full-fledged medical doctor who's gone through 4 years of medical school, 3 or 4 years of training as a resident. On top of that, so maybe you can get by with, to improve access to care, maybe you can get by with a nurse practitioner who is uh, a also a very, you know, well-trained professional. And so a number of states have expanded the scope of practice in the last 20 plus years. And so what we study is the effect that that has. One of the interesting and more novel aspects of our paper is that we're the first to bring in this huge data set from a company called Burning Glass Technologies. And what they do is they scrape all the billions of job listings that are online. They scrape it off the web and they put it into a format that's capable of allowing for analytics. And so we use that because we feel like, well, that's the best representation of the demand as it's expressed in the labor market for particular, in this case, healthcare professionals, nurse practitioners. And so that's what we study. We have a number of states that expanded in the 2010s, in that decade. And so we do see that there is this quite a large, relatively speaking, increase in the labor demand for these nurse practitioners. Impinges a little bit on the effect of like getting these people into care is that the supply can't move quite as fast. Like it takes a longer amount of time for the, because there's only so many of them at any given time. I mean, they can move between states, and then of course people can get spurred on to obtain the additional training necessary to become a nurse practitioner. And most nursing schools are actively training, including here at DePaul, we're actively training nurse practitioners and sending them out into the world. So that's kind of the that's the upshot, the short version of our paper. So we do find that there is this effect, and it has broader implications, I think. It kind of highlights the fact that, well, I mean, I should be clear that the American Medical Association is not very happy with scope
of practice. Yeah, for obvious reasons.
Yeah, because these might crowd out physicians who often are members of the AMA from their customers, in effect. And so we don't really find too much evidence of that kind of substitution going on. We look at earnings, we look at income as best we can in the data. We don't see really compelling evidence. There is some evidence in the past, and there's a hint of something going on, but basically, physician earnings more or less stay the same. Nurse practitioner earnings do go up after scope of practice is expanded, because now they can do more things. And bill for more services.
But I found also sort of interesting, somewhat counterintuitive, is that so the inelastic nurse practitioner labor supply, which basically tells me that, as you were saying, you cannot change these things very quick because you need to have people go to school and get educated. So my daughter's an OBGYN resident at Case Western in Cleveland. And I worked for a large pharmaceutical company for a long time. As I was mentioning to you, when I was in Chicago, I actually had, a host family, sort of, and she was going downtown Chicago to, she was a nurse practitioner. And that is a grueling schedule. You wake up, you're basically sleeping through the day, and then you go to Cook County Hospital, to do the nurse practitioner work. I don't know. I mean, let me throw this out to you. So there's a supply constraint that not many people are going into the profession, it seems to me. The U.S. has been relying on immigration, actually, in some ways. to sort of plug the gap. And I don't know where that is now. I mean, I haven't really followed the industry. And so even if we expand SOP, there is still an issue, right? I mean, if we can't find people, we can't really move the needle much.
No, that's fair. I think that is spot on, and that's our sense as well, that it will take time to get more people into the profession. I think one of the things that we are able to look at that I guess is to your point that you make about it can be a pretty grueling schedule, and then you may be working in a hospital setting. One of the things we do find is that we do see nurse practitioners moving out of the sort of large organizations and into more clinic-based, and we even see some effects on self-employment. So this, this is sort of a nice thing that you can see as a nurse practitioner. You can now independently bill for healthcare services without the need to have a physician, who costs a lot of money, on hand to basically sign off on everything you do. Again, we're not talking about brain surgery here. Nothing like that. So like you can get people.
It's primary care. Fundamentally
it's primary care. Yes. And if there's something that's too serious, it'll get referred on to, basically the emergency room, something like that. And so that could be very helpful in many sort of commonly occurring health conditions where somebody wants to go to the doctor. Or wants to see somebody about a condition that's troubling them, and it can be a more accessible first line of treatment. And so that fills out, I think, a little bit more of the story of what we find. You are exactly right, though, that on immigration, I forget the exact number, but it's something on the order of 40% of all healthcare workers. Mm. Are immigrants. That continues to be a very large fraction here in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge risk issue in some ways. So if you get the next president wants to shut down immigration without a clear understanding of how the American economy works, there's a lot of implications, right? I mean, so we are spending $4.5 trillion a year. This is our biggest chunk of money of US GDP. And if you say, a good part of that is coming through immigration workers, and then we have some sort of, brain dead policy of shutting down immigration, that could have a huge impact, right, on the economy.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to get too far out of my lane, but I mean, I do think that, I do think that a lot of the debate boils down to high skill versus low skill. I think, there's clearly demand for both. And, I mean, people can rightly worry about substitution, from natives to potential immigrants, and have a reasoned debate on that. But yeah, I mean, it's certainly a complicated issue, and in healthcare, there's certainly a long history of dependency, really across the spectrum, from the lowest skilled healthcare work, non-physician providers, all the way up to physicians, where we are a healthcare economy that very much depends on immigrants to help take care of us. So that.
Yeah, I mean, the beauty of your paper, so we're talking about primary care here. So primary care, preventative, I mean, we haven't been very good in preventative care. We are very good, when things are really bad. We can go in and surgically remove things and all sorts of things. I mean, we've got all sorts of technology to do this. But the U.S. hasn't been very good in preventative care.
Yeah,
that's fundamentally driven by primary care. And so, I'm sitting here in Connecticut, and I've been waiting to see my primary care physician for about like 6 months now. Mm-hmm. I was reading through your paper, and I was thinking, There's a problem here. There's sort of let me throw this out to you to respond. So some sort of hierarchical, and I'm just thinking about policy here. So suppose there are 1,000 people, and 990 of them just need some, metformin or hypertension drug, and it's just perfectly fine to see a nurse practitioner. And then there is, I don't know, 100 people who require a high level of expertise. Shouldn't you really think about designing a system that way? I mean, that way we can get people in faster. They don't sort of slip through the cracks. So is there a sort of a system redesign that we should be thinking about?
Well, I mean, yeah, I think it's a great question. You raise a point that as is certainly not a new one that we tend to do in the US pretty bad on prevention. We're good at responding after you're ill. A lot of people, a lot of good arguments here, that you can't bill for preventive, and yet you can bill to have, a knee replaced or something, and bill quite well. But to avoid the set of conditions and circumstances from overweight obesity that leads to the degradation of the knee in the first place, how do you what do you do what do you do with that? And a lot of it is behaviors. I mean, I don't want to, you can't pin all this on healthcare. You really you do want a healthcare system that can respond to the need, and then hopefully people have, the incentives then to avoid the bad conditions in the first place. And I mean, realistically, right, how effective is, say, a 15-minute office visit once a year going to be to actually change your behavior, really, change your eating habits, exercise, do all the things you're supposed to do it before you walked in the doctor's office, and you when you walk out, you're going to go back to your old routines. Like, I personally can't blame the healthcare system for that. I don't think it's fair to, your other points, I think are very well taken. That, and I think I think largely physicians' offices kind of do build, the sort of implicit triage that goes on, where, well, you just need to see the nurse today, get some blood taken, we'll do follow-up, make it efficient, follow-up over the phone, stuff like that. Most modern offices do that to varying degrees, employing, RNs, LPNs, physician assistants. That's another category that we haven't even talked about. And so that, there are all of these people are out there in service to our health, and always doing the best they can for us. But yeah, it's challenging. And yeah, we could probably spend at least a few hours talking about, payment systems and what sorts of incentives that creates. And
No, so so the $4.5 trillion we spend every year on healthcare, one could argue perhaps that two-thirds of that are related to obesity. And obesity gets into type 2 diabetes and hypertension. That's sort of two-thirds of the cost. And that gets into really bad problems later on that we are really good. Once it gets really bad, we are very good at taking care of that. But what we haven't done is to prevent that. And so you need more frequent visits to the clinic. We need to get patients into the clinic a lot faster than they would otherwise have, because these things are, they don't have any symptoms actually till things get really bad. Type 2 diabetes and hypertension, there are no symptoms. So you're just sitting in your couch and watching TV all day, eating hamburgers and drinking soda. At some point, things get really bad. And so the nurse practitioner aspect, I think, is a huge, hugely important thing, how we could bring down this $4.5 trillion to, you know, more manageable. I mean, it is clearly not manageable with the Medicare, Medicaid thing, you know, getting out of hand. And so I think there is sort of a system redesign question here.
Yeah, I tend to be a little more skeptical on that, because I do think that so much of what you're describing there is behavioral, you know, on the part of individuals, and is really complex, and is a function of our own successes as a society to create such an abundance that.
Yeah.
I mean, a literal abundance of so much cheap and delicious food that we are eating ourselves to an early grave, to put it very frankly. You know, and I'm a little skeptical that more health care can actually, I'm skeptical that prevention and the prevention strategies that are out there actually work. Just work, period, let alone are in any way passing a cost benefit kind of test. Now, you know, we are also talking in the age of Ozempic and you know, pharmacological intervention that can have has proven to have dramatic effects on weight loss. And I won't claim to understand it, but I do know the results. And it's, you know, something on the order of 20 to 30% loss of body weight. And so, you know, I don't know where that's gonna go. It's also $1,000 a month. So that times, you know, the fraction of the population that's overweight or at least obese, you know, that's a lot of money. So I'm, you know, to put it very mildly. So I don't know where this is all going to go. I am optimistic that as more companies enter this market, we'll see more price competition, and then $1,000 a month will turn into 500, and then maybe 250, and then maybe, you know, 100, and people will just, you know, be popping these things like a Pez dispenser. I don't know. I mean, it'll be really interesting to see how this plays out and how much people can.
So I want to go to another paper you have. So it's very interesting. So when and why providers do not respond to changes in reimbursement rates. So you say here, policies to reduce healthcare payments can lead to healthcare access issues if providers reduce their supply in response to reimbursement rate reductions. We examined the impact of a policy that reduced reimbursement rates by 30% in a workers' compensation insurance system that provided generous reimbursement rates relative to other payers even after the rate reduction. The results suggest that provider supply is inelastic as at the part of the reimbursement distribution that we study. So, yeah, so this is really interesting. So the intuition here would be when you reduce reimbursement rates, providers reduce services. In the basic sort of demand supply economics question. But what you are saying here is that there's sort of a system effect here. So what is causing this? That, you know, suppose I'm a payer, and I go out and I say, hey guys, you know, I'm going to reduce your reimbursement rate by 50%.
Yeah,
and then I don't see any sort of effect on actual care provided. How can I understand this?
So this is another paper that I wrote with some colleagues a few years ago. And so this is a paper that is, I don't want to claim any sort of external generalizability here which is where the mind wants to go with it, you know, like
this is Illinois, right?
It is Illinois, and we're talking about reimbursement, physician reimbursement for injured workers. So that's the workers' comp system. It's basically, you could think of it as sort of a parallel healthcare system that, you know, uses the same pieces of the healthcare system, the same physicians, the same hospitals, and so on, but has its own reimbursement system, and so it just so happens that Illinois, for many years, paid reimbursed physicians enormously for the care that they delivered to injured workers. And it was off of a fee schedule where the state basically said, this is the reimbursement rate. And physicians love it. I mean, it's great, you know, because it's so far above what they get reimbursed from private insurance companies, from Medicare, from certainly Medicaid. And so when an injured worker walks in the door of the clinic, cha-ching, that's what the physician thinks. Okay, maybe not, I don't know. But it's so what Illinois did a number of years ago was they said, well, you know, we need, you know, because who pays this? Well, the employers pay this, okay? The employers pay these fees. No cost sharing, there's no cost sharing to the injured worker, but the employers pay it, and they complain eventually enough that the state says, well, we need to cut, you know, we need to do something, we need to reform workers' comp, we're out of line. And they truly were just really an outlier across the other 49 states. And so they just summarily, they just said, we're going to cut it 30%. And so that really just brought it kind of down to the middle of the pack, really, with respect to the other states. And so what you saw then was that, so we studied the effect. We saw, you know, well, what sorts of procedures were done? Was there any effect? So it's this interesting kind of paper that where we're selling a non-result. There's this huge, what if you cut reimbursement by a third and nothing happened? And that is the story. I mean, really, you know, it goes on for 20 pages and we describe why is that the case and why that is interesting. And the short version of that is that when the reimbursement starts so high, even cutting at 30%, it's still really good.
it's still really good
money. It's still above what Blue Cross Blue Shield is paying, what United Healthcare is paying, what the government's paying for Medicare and Medicaid. And so you basically, if you're a physician, we find that the providers didn't change the amount of care they delivered. And so we describe this as effectively an inelastic supply curve, because the worry would be, like, if you take, and there are plenty of studies looking at this, like cutting Medicaid reimbursement. Medicaid reimbursement is generally the lowest reimbursement on the hierarchy. And you cut it, and what do you see? You see more and more physicians will not take Medicaid patients. They opt out. So that's an elastic supply response, or at least not an inelastic one. They'll opt out, they'll treat fewer patients, they won't take new patients. But when it starts so high, you cut 30%, basically it's all still gravy. You know, this is where, or at least there's a lot of gravy there. And so that's what we find. And we calculate out, you know, how much the state was, how this state policy, how much this saved employers, and it was a very large number when you add it up and sum it up over the time period. And
you say it's like $400 million.
It's like $400 million. Yeah. And that's again one state, you know, for a time frame, for several years. And so that's, you know, that's, you know, obviously, it, you know, it's when
it's
you,
big.
It's big. It's big. Yeah. For just workers comp.
Yes,
but again, I wouldn't generalize it to any, say Medicare should cut 30%. No, you're going to get a response.
I would so much love to generalize this, Tony.
Yes.
And so I was thinking, you know, can I go into healthcare systems and sort of titrate things down, not permanently, but, you know, just like a chemistry lab. I'm going to titrate things down to get to optimality, because it might be that we have a lot of excesses in the system that we haven't really found. I appreciate what you're saying. This is a very specific case, one state, workers' compensation, and so on and so forth. But I wondered, it is, I mean, it may not be 30%. I mean, even if we can cut 5%, in the larger context, could be quite interesting.
Well, you know, see, the thing is, there have been studies that have looked at sort of the small changes. I mean, very clever studies that take advantage of kind of small changes in how. And the one I'm thinking of is a Medicare reimbursement. So that's health insurance, healthcare for older Americans. And you know, you'll see a situation where a primary care payment is reduced a small amount, 5%, and you will see that there's a response. So they'll treat fewer patients. Mm. They will do further. You know, they will reduce the intensity of care. It does matter as you go down the different payers. Now, you know, you could say for private insurers, well, they're bargaining in some way with providers, and at least the providers have some say to varying degrees over what they get reimbursed by a private insurer. The government, well, they have to kind of take what they can get when you're talking about Medicare and Medicaid. And so, you know, the evidence is that they do respond. And they will, you know, treat less when they receive less money.
So that's a bad outcome, especially in primary care. You want patients before they get into trouble to get into the clinic.
Yeah.
And that is a societal sort of utility issue.
Yeah.
So you have another paper here, which is sort of related, insurer market power and hospital prices in the U.S., You say here the extent to which concentration in health insurance market affects negotiated prices paid to hospitals is of high interest to policymakers. You say here we examined the association between insurer market share and hospital prices using a new source of data obtained through the Federal Hospital Price Transparency Initiative. So we know, I mean, they're sort of two people here. There's the payer, there's the provider. They're on the negotiating table. And there's sort of a market power question here, right? So whoever has more market power. in some sense, you know, you're talking about market power here on the payer side, but there's also market power on the provider side. If there's only one hospital in the county,
right.
That hospital has a lot of power too, right? So what are you finding here in the data?
Yeah, so this is a paper that really takes advantage of a new source of information that started coming out a few years ago, just quite recently. This whereby providers, hospitals have to disclose, they have to put out machine readable data on the prices that they receive for services rendered.
For all the procedures.
For
like
all
CBD,
the procedures.
CBD
the entire code. Book. Yeah. Every procedure. And so we were able to put put some of this together, and for a good number of hospitals, a couple thousand hospitals, and what our question was is, well, you know, what you said is very true, that in some markets, a hospital can be the only game in town. In other markets, there are many competing hospitals. But we were kind of interested in the other side of the negotiating table, and that's the insurer. So insurance markets, in general, tend to be a lot more concentrated, although it varies, again, than provider markets. But again, it varies. And so when you have these two, you know, to use the jargon economic, you have these two kind of oligopolies battling each other.
Yeah.
It's not obvious what the outcome is, who wins. Because if you got a, you know, if you have a hospital that's a monopoly, basically the insurer has no choice but to work with them. And the hospital can demand, you know, pretty high reimbursement rates for services. Conversely, you could have a situation where, like many states actually, the insurer is 90% of the book of business, the covered lives in the area. And you have a smattering of hospitals around, and the hospitals know if we don't contract with this insurer, 90% of our customers are gone. Yeah. You know, so that now shifts, you know, the that shifts the bargaining power much more on the insurer side. So what we did was a very simple exercise here to basically compare in a snapshot, kind of cross-sectional manner, what were the differences that we saw in hospital prices paid by insurers when the dominant insurer, the market leader, was a near monopoly. So we had some thresholds. We divided the country into sort of three groups, sort of one more competitive, the most competitive markets, the middle competitive insurance markets, and then the least competitive, where the dominant insurer has more than 70% of the covered lives. And so what we found was that, well, in the least competitive markets, the prices were 15% lower. So those dominant insurers were able to extract one way or another a 15% versus if they had been in a more competitive market, the first type of market where it's more competitive. And so that, you know, my takeaway from that was that, well, a couple takeaways. I mean, it's that, well, is this a lot? You know, like 15%, that's a big number. I mean, we just got done talking about a 30% reduction. So 15% does sound like a lot. Now, again, but that's an extreme. I mean, that is an extreme. That's making a virtue out of a near monopoly insurance market.
Yes.
And so then the question then becomes, well, what happens next? This is something we often ask in economics. Well, what happens next? Where what do they do with that 15% that they're able to extract from the providers, from the hospitals? Like, do they pass it on in the form of lower premiums to the people purchasing insurance, employers and unions and governments who buy insurance from those market leaders? Or do they just keep it and
it goes to the shareholders, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, redecorate the lobby of the insurance. Unfortunately, I don't know the answer to that second question about what do they do with it when they get those? I mean, the economist in me says, well, there's really, if they're that dominant of an insurer, there's nothing to force them. There's no mechanism in the market. It's not like the employers can say, well, give us lower premiums or we're going to go to the other insurers. I mean, they might, but maybe those are just too small, but they could. I mean, there needs to be some kind of a credible threat of an alternative in order for market for the market mechanism to work. And I think that's something that I've been trying to think about how to do next to answer that question. And that's still a work in progress right now. So I don't know what they do at the 15th.
Yeah, I quite like this price transparency initiative. And so I was thinking, Tony, that if it's an elective surgery, you don't necessarily have to localize it. I mean, you know, the country could be your playground. So if I'm in Chicago or New York, and if I get better prices in Oklahoma or Texas, I might want to use that. But right now, we don't have transparency at that level, right? So the patients are sort of making decisions in the absence of complete information.
Yeah, I was a big, I think when I was younger, maybe more foolish, I don't know. I did believe that maybe price transparency combined with consumers who had skin in the game, you know, so as the expression is, that could change behavior. I'm not sure that I believe that story, which I told myself for a number of years. I don't think what I have seen is that people don't take advantage. And I've seen some very slick transparency tools, very slick pricing tools. Yeah. That, and insurers have rolled these out. And I've looked at some of them and I've seen them. They're very slick. They give you all the information you need. They let you price shop, you know, and you don't have to go. And that's not going from New York to Oklahoma. That's like just within your market, you know, what the variation is. They're great, but nobody uses them. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just don't use them. And I don't know if it's some kind of a design flaw of the software or or of the people. I don't know. Like, it's just that you don't, it's not your first, when the doctor tells you that you need surgery, your first impulse is not to like pull out an app and look and see where can I get it done. And that's just human nature. You know, I got bigger things to worry about. And plus, insurance is going to pay for it anyways. So like, what are you, you know, I mean, maybe for the small stuff, but then, you know, how do you move the needle if people are just deciding on, I don't know, you know, I should have my lab work done over here instead of over here because it's $10 cheaper and it's coming out of my pocket because I'm under my deductible like that. So, you know, is that going to move the needle? Well, you know, and who's going to really, you know, how many people have to do that in order for you to move the needle? I don't think it's all that feasible. Now, where I do think that price track, because I'm a fan of price transparency too, I think what'll be interesting to see is not whether consumers / patients look at it, but whether competitors look and see what their competition down the street is getting paid by the same insurer. You know, and does it change the way, does it change the dynamic of bargaining among providers, among different providers who compete with each other and are trying to get the highest reimbursement from the given insurer, from all the insurers? And that remains to be seen, because now it's out there and you can be sure that they're all, that vendors are selling it and packaging it to all the providers and saying, hey, look, you know, you're not charging enough because and it's also not immediately obvious that prices go down in that scenario either, because it might just be that they bargain hard to get higher reimbursements and the prices go up because of transparency. That's not impossible to get that.
Yeah, I mean, we have done this in private pay. So, you know, Cleveland Clinic is a good example of this. And, you know, it's a lot to do with marketing and branding. People come to Cleveland and they go to Cleveland Clinic and get their stuff done, pay millions of dollars for it, which is a sort of a different thing than sort of an ordinary American who could have options or, you know, choices, right? So it's sort of an interesting thing. I mean, Medicare and Medicaid should be interested in this concept, which is, there's scale in healthcare. I mean, clearly scale in healthcare. So rather than going to the county hospital, the two doctors, it's probably a lot cheaper to sort of accumulate and aggregate and provide at scale healthcare, right? I mean, I don't know. I mean, just speculating.
I think certainly, yes. Like, yeah, you as a patient do not want to go get your liver transplant done at a hospital that does 3 liver transplants a year. You want to go to the place that does 3 a day. You know, you want to go. So there certainly is a scale effect, but in terms of certainly on efficiency, and certainly, you know, this what's called a volume outcome relationship.
On outcomes, yeah.
Yeah, just that you'll get better outcomes, and that's just by virtue of the fact that the places that do it a lot become very skilled at doing it without complications. Doesn't mean that, you know, it works every time, but you have a much better shot. So certainly, you know, it's not an automatic that more hospitals, more providers, when we're talking about, you know, kind of specialized, comparatively rare services, transplants, cancer, these types of things, you don't really want to do those as a patient at the neighborhood community hospital. Like, you're better off going to the academic medical center. You might have to pay more for parking. It's a longer drive, but the outcomes are going to be worth it. That's something I don't think enough. I don't think enough, quote unquote, real people know that volume outcomes thing is real, yeah. Matters.
That's an issue. So I want to finish up with the other paper you have. Differences in starting pay for male and female physicians persist. Explanations for the gender gap remain elusive. So you see here, large literature has documented differences in salary between male and female physicians. While few observers doubt that women earn less on average than men do, the extent to which certain factors contribute to the salary difference remains a topic of considerable debate. Yeah, so I wasn't actually aware, you know, my daughter is probably very interested in this, in this conversation. Mm-hmm. I wasn't actually aware that, so we had a lot of, you know, sort of male-female difference issue discussed on the podcast. But my biased intuition was that in the professional level, this couldn't be the case.
Yeah.
But you're finding that is not the case, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I'm really interested in, I guess, as you could tell, my interests span healthcare labor market. Hence, you know, we're talking about physicians, physician pay, physician reimbursement, and health insurance markets, which, you know, kind of ties into some of the earlier stuff we talked about. And so this topic is one that I've had a long-standing interest in. I think on average, my joke is I come back to this topic once a decade. And so I wrote a paper, I guess probably around 15 or so years ago, maybe not quite that long, where I documented a gender difference in pay. And it's called something like the $16,819 pay difference between men and women in their starting salaries. for physicians. And so that earlier paper is what led to the more recent one that came out a couple of years ago that you just alluded to. So I have to just provide a little bit of context, and I'll talk about the old paper, and then I'll talk about what we tried to do with the new. So the older paper, it showed that and it took advantage of a pretty long, so about a decade's worth of data. So starting in around 2008, 2009, and then went forward to about, I don't know, how far did we go forward? I'd probably say 2015 or 16, something like that.
Yeah.
I can't remember exactly, but probably not that long. But in any case, what we saw was that in the earlier years, we actually didn't find a difference.
Oh wow!
Now again, to be clear, that's controlling for a lot of factors. So if you just look at the raw numbers, yes, women. If you just said women versus men starting salary, one of the virtues of what I'm doing here is it's starting pay. They're just finishing residency, which you can appreciate because your daughter is probably the completion of her residency. And then she will be confronted with job opportunities, and she will pick one of them. And if she's in New York State, she will receive this survey, which I'm not involved with, but the people who gave me the data are at SUNY Albany, and they collect the data. They do a resident exit survey. And part of that is, are you taking a job in clinical care? And then they ask you a bunch of questions about including salary and hours of work and all this other stuff. So, that sets the stage. I look at it now. If you you want to control for the fact that women have historically been more likely to go into primary care. Primary care does not pay as well as surgical procedural specialties. There are comparatively few women orthopedic surgeons out there, and surgeons of all types, and those are high paying specialties. So you are going to see a difference in the raw numbers, but you can control for that with statistical methods, regressions, and then you see, well, what remains. And what was sort of surprising in this earlier paper is that in the earlier years, 2008, I think, was the first year, we didn't see a difference, but then it grew over the next several years to
That's
be $16,819, which is about 8%. You know, it's and again, that's control. And so that left us after writing this first paper, kind of scratching our heads. We didn't know what to make of this. This is an unexplained gap. Because again, we tried to explain it with everything we had. We had their specialty. We knew things about their hours of work, where they trained, all sorts of other factors that we controlled for in our model, and still this difference came out. And so, in the earlier paper, I wrote some things in there saying that, well, maybe what we're seeing here is that unobserved attributes, unobserved job attributes, unobserved to me.
Yeah.
Like for instance, you know, me, the analyst, I don't know about how much call you have, how many weekends you have to work, how many nights.
Yeah.
You know, various undesirable attributes.
Sort of work-life balance issue.
Work-life balance characteristics, exactly. So we didn't observe any of that. And so my speculation, pure speculation at the time in the earlier paper was that, well, maybe what we're seeing here is that as women became and continue to be now a much more dominant part of the physician labor force, that they're able to obtain more of these favorable work-life balance attributes. Mm. Pure speculation, you know, that's what I said. And however, you know, those come at a cost, right? Like if you can't take call or you have restrictions and, you know, you don't want to work weekends, you may be willing to trade off of some salary for those work-life balance factors. That was my speculation. So, okay, yeah. We published it, you know, what, yeah, fine. I then continued to, I talked to the people who collect the data, like I said, the folks at SUNY Albany, they're our co-authors on this newer paper. And I said, let's try to add some questions. Let's try to see if this is actually happening. And so we added a bunch of work-life balance questions, like how important to you is having no call or predictable work hours, no work on weekends. So we added a series of questions, and then we waited, and I waited patiently as a few years of data came in, and then I got the data again, did the same sorts of models that I did in the earlier paper, and I figured that I was gonna drop these because mind you, like, women cared much more and care in these data much more about these work-life balance factors than men do. Very distinct differences between them. So I figured I'm gonna drop these characteristics into my regression model, and it's gonna make that unexplained gap go away. And I'll tell you, Gil, that to this day, I have still not been as shocked from a regression. I mean, I sit around computers all day playing with data. This was as shocked, I think, as I've ever been in my professional career, because they did nothing. They explained nothing. They had no bearing on that unexplained gap, which incidentally had gotten bigger in the more recent years. So
it's very surprising. Is it very surprising? I mean, you have to look at starting salaries here. So these are women, who are sort of thinking about starting a family. And so, it's very surprising that the work-life balance issue had no power to explain it.
Yeah. Yes. I sitting here right now to this day, I did this years ago. I still can't believe it. I mean, I am still struck by it. Because it leaves me wondering, well, what am I missing? Like, what am I? I mean, because, one's mind might go to, okay, well, it's discrimination. And I say, okay, I mean, that's a hypothesis, but then you have to go back and tell me why, when there were fewer women in the physician labor force in 1999, was there less? Like, I would have thought discrimination would be worse in the past and now. So, I don't know. I've not gotten a compelling answer from anybody on that, but maybe it is. Maybe it is. I don't know.
Yeah, I know nothing about this, Tony. So I'm thinking, some sort of game theoretic approach to this, which is the hiring manager is learning information over time, and he or she started with X, and then X minus 10 worked, X minus 20 worked, and over 20 years, now X minus 400. work. And so this is sort of an optimization problem in some ways from a hiring manager's perspective, I'm thinking.
Yeah, I mean, no, I get that. It's just, I still have to reconcile it with, are they doing, are the hiring managers doing something different now? Because they have to be doing something different now than they were doing, say, 20 years ago or something like that, 25 years ago now. Because I have to have something, to explain it going from basically no gap to a quite large gap, on the order of, 10%. I need a thing that, there's a huge literature. I know you had Francine Blau on the podcast a couple months ago, and she is a top-notch, labor economist, has studied this stuff for years, and there are many people who've studied the broader issue, and there's also many, it spawned many other literatures looking documenting the fact that, well, women tend not to negotiate as hard. I mean, this is not my research. These are published studies out there. But still, I have to explain how they got worse at negotiation. You know, if that's the story, if you want to tell me a negotiation story, well, either the men have gotten so much better or the women have gotten worse at negotiating. Because that's how you get an increase in the gap in pay. And I don't know. I mean, I'm probably due to write another paper here in about 5 years, and I'll take another crack at it. But
it's really puzzling. Sort of the macro question would be, well, this is taking to places we don't really want to talk about, but did the country change last 20 years?
I mean, you know, I guess the question, you know, sure, there have been lots of changes, but you know, what you saw is that, well, you know, now what are the fractions now in medical school? It's at least even, right? 50-50 men, women, maybe even more women. You know,
yeah, totally. Yeah.
So like you've really seen, you know, a sea change over, say, the last 25 years in terms of women applicants, women in medical school, women, you know, obviously in residency. I mean, you know, you could still say there's still more male doctors in the field because, you know, because historically there were more men. Yeah. But the number, that fraction is getting smaller over time. If it was a story of the gap shrinking over time,
I got plenty of explanations for that. Yeah.
But not one of the gap growing. That's what puzzled me. And then, yeah, I mean, this was a real, this is sort of, you caught me like, you know, after, you know, having written now, you know, a couple of papers on this over the span of 10, 15 years, I feel like I'm no closer to an answer. and it's something I do want to come back to, if only to, I'm a quantitative kind of guy, and it's made me want to become maybe more qualitative and actually sit down and talk to people.
Just stay quantitative. I mean, there's nothing to be done. I won't talk
to people then.
Excellent, Tony. Yeah, thanks so much for spending time with me.
Well, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you. I've enjoyed it very much.
Thank you.